did not have the same strictures against analogy, but were still careful. The ancients were more caustic. This problem of iatrogenics is not new, and doctors have been traditionally the butt of jokes. Martial, in his epigrams, gives us an idea of the perceived expert problem in medicine in his time. I thought that Delus was a doctor, not a caretaker, but for him it appears to be the same job. Nuper erat medicus nunc est vispilo Delus, quod vispilo facit, fecerat ed medicus. Or, I did not feel ill, Symmachy, now I do, after your ministrations. Non habui febrem, Symmachy, nunc habeo. The Greek term pharmakon is ambiguous, as it can mean both poison and cure, and has been used as a pun to warn against iatrogenics by the Arab doctor Ruhawi. An attribution problem arises when the person imputes his positive results to his own skills and his failures to luck. Nicocles, as early as the 4th century BC, asserts that doctors claimed responsibility for success and blamed failure on nature, or on some external cause. The very same idea was rediscovered by psychologists some 24 centuries later, and applied to stockbrokers, doctors, and managers of companies. According to an ancient anecdote, the Emperor Hadrian continually exclaimed, as he was dying, that it was his doctors who had killed him. Montaigne, mostly a synthesizer of classical writers, has his essays replete with anecdotes. A Lacedaemonian was asked what had made him live so long. He answered, ignoring medicine. Montaigne also detected the agency problem, or why the last thing a doctor needs is for you to be healthy. No doctor derives pleasure from the health of his friends, wrote the ancient Greek satirist, no soldier from the peace of his city, etc. Nul médecin ne prend plaisir à la santé de ses amis mesme. Dit l'ancien comique grec, ni soldat à la paix de sa vie. Ainsi du reste. How to medicate half the population. Recall how a personal doctor can kill you. We saw in the story of the grandmother our inability to distinguish in our logical reasoning, though not in intuitive actions, between average and other richer properties of what we observe. I was once attending a lunch party at the country house of a friend when someone produced a handheld blood pressure measuring tool. Tempted, I measured my arterial pressure, and it turned out to be slightly higher than average. A doctor, who was part of the party and had a very friendly disposition, immediately pulled out a piece of paper prescribing some medication to lower it, which I later threw in the garbage can. I subsequently bought the same measuring tool and discovered that my blood pressure was much lower, hence better, than average, except once in a while, when it peaked episodically. In short, it exhibits some variability, like everything in life. This random variability is often mistaken for information, hence leading to intervention. Let us play a thought experiment, without making any assumption on the link between blood pressure and health. Further, assume that normal pressure is a certain known number. Take a cohort of healthy persons. Suppose that because of randomness, half the time a given person's pressure will be above that number, and half the time, for the same person, the measurement will be below. So on about half the doctor's visits, they will show the alarming above normal. If the doctor automatically prescribes medication on the days the patients are above normal, then half the normal population will be on medication. And note that we are quite certain that their life expectancy will be reduced by unnecessary treatments. Clearly, I am simplifying here. Sophisticated doctors are aware of the variable nature of the measurements and do not prescribe medication when the numbers are not compelling, though it is easy to fall into the trap, and not all doctors are sophisticated. But the thought experiment can show how frequent visits to the doctor, particularly outside the cases of a life-threatening ailment or an uncomfortable condition, just like frequent access to information, can be harmful. This example also shows us the process outlined in Chapter 7, by which a personal doctor ends up killing the patient simply by overreacting to noise. This is more serious than you think. It seems that medicine has a hard time grasping normal variability in samples. It is hard sometimes to translate the difference between statistically significant and significant in effect. A certain disease might marginally lower your life expectancy, but it can be deemed to do so with high statistical significance, prompting panics, when in fact, all these studies might be saying is they established with a significant statistical margin that in some cases, say 1% of the cases, patients are likely to be harmed by it. Let me rephrase. The magnitude of the result, the importance of the effect, is not captured by what is called statistical significance, something that tends to deceive specialists. We need to look in two dimensions. How much a condition, say blood pressure, a certain number of points higher than normal, is likely to affect your life expectancy, and how significant the result is. Why is this serious? If you think that the statistician really understands statistical significance in the complicated texture of real life, the large world as opposed to the small world of textbooks, some surprises. Kahneman and Tversky showed that statisticians themselves made practical mistakes in real life in violation of their teachings, forgetting that they were statisticians. Thinking, I remind the listener, requires effort. My colleague Daniel Goldstein and I did some research on quants, professionals of quantitative finance, and realized that the overwhelming majority did not understand the practical effect of elementary notions such as variance or standard deviation, concepts they used in about every one of their equations. A recent powerful study by Emre Sawyer and Robin Hogarth showed that many professionals and experts in the field of econometrics, supplying pompous numbers such as regression and correlation, made egregious mistakes translating into practice the numbers they were producing themselves. They get the equation right, but make severe translation mistakes when expressing it into reality. In all cases, they underestimate randomness and underestimate the uncertainty in the results. And we are talking about errors of interpretation made by the statisticians, not by the users of statistics, such as social scientists and doctors. Alas, all these biases lead to action, almost never inaction. In addition, we now know that the craze against fats and the fat-free slogans result from an elementary mistake in interpreting the results of a regression. When two variables are jointly responsible for an effect, here carbohydrates and fat, sometimes one of them shows sole responsibility. Many fell into the error of attributing problems under joint consumption of fat and carbohydrates to fat rather than carbohydrates. Further, the great statistician and debunker of statistical misinterpretation, David Friedman, showed, very convincingly, with a co-author, that the link everyone is obsessing about between salt and blood pressure has no statistical basis. It may exist for some hypertensive people, but it is more likely the exception than the rule. The rigor of mathematics in medicine. For those of us who laugh at the charlatanism hidden behind fictional mathematics in social science, one may wonder why this did not happen to medicine. And indeed, the cemetery of bad ideas and hidden ideas shows that mathematics fooled us there. There have been many forgotten attempts to mathematize medicine. There was a period during which medicine derived its explanatory models from the physical sciences. Giovanni Borelli, in De Motu Animalium, compared the body to a machine consisting of animal levers. Hence, we could apply the rules of linear physics. Let me repeat. I am not against rationalized learned discourse, provided it is not fragile to error. I am first and last a decision-maker hybrid and will never separate the philosopher probabilist from the decision-maker. So I am that joint person all the time. In the morning when I drink the ancient liquid called coffee, at noon when I eat with my friends, and at night when I go to bed clutching a book. What I am against is naive, rationalized, pseudo-learned discourse with green lumber problems, one that focuses solely on the known and ignores the unknown. Nor am I against the use of mathematics when it comes to gauging the importance of the unknown. This is the robust application of mathematics. Actually, the arguments in this chapter and the next are all based on the mathematics of probability. But it is not a rationalistic use of mathematics, and much of it allows the detection of blatant inconsistencies between statements about severity of disease and intensity of treatment. On the other hand, the use of mathematics in social science is like interventionism. Those who practice it professionally tend to use it everywhere except where it can be useful. The only condition for such a brand of more sophisticated rationalism? To believe and act as if one does not have the full story. To be sophisticated, you need to accept that you are not so. Next, this chapter has introduced the idea of convexity effects and burden of evidence into medicine and into the assessment of risk of iatrogenics. Next, let us look at more applications of convexity effects and discuss via negativa as a rigorous approach to life. Chapter 22, Medicine by Subtraction, introduces the match between individuals and the type of randomness in the environment. Why I don't want to live forever. To live long, but not too long. Wednesdays and Fridays, plus Lent. How to live forever, according to Nietzsche or others, or why, when you think about it, not to live longer. Life expectancy and convexity. Whenever you question some aspects of medicine, or unconditional technological progress, you are invariably and promptly provided the sophistry that we tend to live longer than past generations. Note that some make the even sillier argument that a propensity to natural things implies favoring a return to the day of brutish and short lives, not realizing it is the exact same argument as saying that eating fresh, non-canned foods implies rejecting civilization, the rule of law, and humanism. So there are a lot of nuances in this life expectancy argument. Life expectancy has increased because of the combination of many factors: sanitation, penicillin, a drop in crime, life-saving surgery, and of course, some medical practitioners operating in severe life-threatening situations. If we live longer, it is thanks to medicine's benefits in cases that are lethal, in which the condition is severe. Hence low iatrogenics, as we saw, the convex cases. So it is a serious error to infer that if we live longer because of medicine, that all medical treatments make us live longer. Further, to account for the effect of progress, we need to deduct, of course, from the gains in medical treatment, the costs of the diseases of civilization. Primitive societies are largely free of cardiovascular disease, cancer, dental cavities, economic theories, lounge music, and other modern ailments. Advances in lung cancer treatment need to be offset by the effect of smoking. From the research papers, one can estimate that medical practice may have contributed a small number of years to the increase, but again, this depends greatly on the gravity of the disease. Cancer doctors certainly provide a positive contribution in advanced and curable cases, while interventionistic personal doctors patently provide a negative one. We need to take into account the unfortunate fact that iatrogenics, hence medicine, reduces life expectancy in a set and easy-to-map number of cases, the concave ones. We have a few pieces of data from the small number of hospital strikes during which only a small number of operations are conducted for the most urgent cases, and elective surgery is postponed. Depending on whose side in the debate you join, life expectancy either increases in these cases or, at the least, does not seem to drop. Further, which is significant, many of the elective surgeries are subsequently canceled upon the return to normalcy, evidence of the denigration of Mother Nature's work by some doctors. Another fooled-by-randomness style mistake is to think that because life expectancy at birth used to be 30 until the last century, that people lived just 30 years. The distribution was massively skewed, with the bulk of the deaths coming from birth and childhood mortality. Conditional life expectancy was high. Just consider that ancestral men tended to die of trauma. Perhaps legal enforcement contributed more than doctors to the increase in length of life, so the gains in life expectancy are more societal than from the result of scientific advance. While there are some controversies concerning conditional life expectancy, the numbers are quite revealing. For instance, on one extreme, Richard Lewontin estimates in the last 50 years, only 4 months have been added to the expected lifespan of a person who is already 60 years old. Data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, show a few more years, but we are still unsure how much of it came from medicine as compared to improvements in life conditions and social mores. Still, the CDC shows that life expectancy at age 20 only increased from 42.79 additional years in 1900 to 1902 to 51.2 in 1949 to 1951 and to 58.2 in 2002. As a case study, consider mammograms. It has been shown that administering them to women over 40 on an annual basis does not lead to an increase in life expectancy. At best, it could even lead to a decrease. While female mortality from breast cancer decreases for the cohort subjected to mammograms, the death from other causes increases markedly. We can spot here simple measurable iatrogenics. The doctor, seeing the tumor, cannot avoid doing something harmful, like surgery followed by radiation, chemotherapy, or both. That is, more harmful than the tumor. There is a break-even point that is easily crossed by panicked doctors and patients. Treating the tumor that will not kill you shortens your life. Chemotherapy is toxic. We have built up so much paranoia against cancer, looking at the chain backward, an error of logic called affirming the consequent. If all of those dying prematurely from cancer had a malignant tumor, that does not mean that all malignant tumors lead to death from cancer. Most equally intelligent persons do not infer from the fact that all cretins are liars that all liars are cretin, or from the condition that all bankers are corrupt that all corrupt people are bankers. Only in extreme cases does nature allow us to make such violations of logic, called modus ponens, in order to help us survive. Overreaction is beneficial in an ancestral environment. Misunderstanding of the problems with mammograms has led to overreactions on the part of politicians, another reason to have a society immune from the stupidity of lawmakers by decentralization of important decisions. One politician of the primitive kind, Hillary Clinton, went so far as to claim that critics of the usefulness of mammograms were killing women. We can generalize the mammogram problem to unconditional laboratory tests, finding deviations from the norm and acting to cure them. Subtraction adds to your life. Now I speculate the following, having looked closely at data with my friend Spiros Makridakis, a statistician and decision scientist who we introduced a few chapters ago as the first to find flaws in statistical forecasting methods. We estimated that cutting medical expenditures by a certain amount, while limiting the cuts to elective surgeries and treatments, would extend people's lives in most rich countries, especially the United States. Why? Simple basic convexity analysis. A simple examination of conditional iatrogenics. The error of treating the mildly ill puts them in a concave position. And it looks as if we know very well how to do this. Just raise the hurdle of medical intervention in favor of cases that are most severe, for which the iatrogenics effect is very small. It may even be better to increase expenditures on these and reduce the one on elective ones. In other words, reason backward, starting from the iatrogenics to the cure, rather than the other way around. Whenever possible, replace the doctor with human anti-fragility, but otherwise don't be shy with aggressive treatments. Another application of via negativa, spend less, live longer, is a subtractive strategy. We saw that iatrogenics comes from the intervention bias, via positiva, the propensity to want to do something, causing all the problems we've discussed. But let's do some via negativa here. Removing things can be quite a potent and, empirically, a more rigorous action. Why? Subtraction of a substance not seasoned by our evolutionary history reduces the possibility of black swans while leaving one open to improvements. Should the improvements occur, we can be pretty comfortable that they are as free of unseen side effects as one can get. So there are many hidden jewels in via negativa applied to medicine. For instance, telling people not to smoke seems to be the greatest medical contribution of the last 60 years. Druin Birch, in Taking the Medicine, writes, "The harmful effects of smoking are roughly equivalent to the combined good ones of every medical intervention developed since the war. Getting rid of smoking provides more benefit than being able to cure people of every possible type of cancer." As usual, the ancients. As Ennius wrote, "The good is mostly in the absence of bad. Nimium boni est, cui nihil est mali." Likewise, happiness is best dealt with as a negative concept. The same non-linearity applies. Modern happiness researchers, who usually look quite unhappy, often psychologists turned economists, or vice versa, do not use non-linearities and convexity effects when they lecture us about happiness, as if we knew what it was and whether that's what we should be after. Instead, they should be lecturing us about unhappiness. I speculate that just as those who lecture on happiness look unhappy, those who lecture on unhappiness would look happy. The pursuit of happiness is not equivalent to the avoidance of unhappiness. Each of us certainly knows not only what makes us unhappy, for instance, copy editors, commuting, bad odors, pain, the sight of a certain magazine in a waiting room, etc., but what to do about it. Let us probe the wisdom of the ages. "Sometimes scantiness of nourishment restores the system," wrote Plotinus, and the ancients believed in purges, one manifestation of which was the oft harmful, though often beneficial, routine of bloodletting. The regimen of the Salerno School of Medicine: joyful mood, rest, and scant nourishment. Si tibi deficiant medici, medici tibi fiant haec tria, mens lita requies moderata dieta. There is a seemingly apocryphal, but nevertheless interesting, story about Pomponius Atticus, famous for being Cicero's relative and epistolary recipient. Being ill, incurably ill, he tried to put an end to both his life and his suffering by abstinence, and only succeeded in ending the latter, as, according to Montaigne, his health was restored. But I am citing the story in spite of its apocryphal nature simply because, from a scientific perspective, it seems that the only way we may manage to extend people's lives is through caloric restriction, which seems to cure many ailments in humans and extend lives in laboratory animals. But, as we will see in the next section, such restriction does not need to be permanent. Just an occasional but painful fast might do. We know we can cure many cases of diabetes by putting people on a very strict starvation-style diet, shocking their system. In fact, the mechanism had to have been known heuristically for a long time, since there are institutes and sanatoria for curative starvation in Siberia. It has been shown that many people benefit from the removal of products that did not exist in their ancestral habitat, sugars and other carbohydrates in unnatural format, wheat products, those with celiac disease, but almost all of us are somewhat ill-adapted to this new addition to the human diet, milk and other cow products, for those of non-Northern European origin who did not develop lactose tolerance, sodas, both diet and regular, wine, for those of Asian origin who do not have the history of exposure, vitamin pills, food supplements, the family doctor, headache medicine, and other painkillers. Reliance on painkillers encourages people to avoid addressing the cause of the headache with trial and error, which can be sleep deprivation, tension in the neck, or bad stressors. It allows them to keep destroying themselves in a Procrustean bed-style life. But one does not have to go far. Just start removing the medications that your doctor gave you, or, preferably, remove your doctor. As Oliver Wendell Holmes Sr. put it, "If all the medications were dumped in the sea, it would be better for mankind, but worse for the fishes." My father, an oncologist, who also did research in anthropology, raised me under that maxim. Alas, while not completely following it in practice. He cited it enough, though. I, for my part, resist eating fruits not found in the ancient Eastern Mediterranean. I use I here in order to show that I am not narrowly generalizing to the rest of humanity. I avoid any fruit that does not have an ancient Greek or Hebrew name, such as mangoes, papayas, even oranges. Oranges seem to be the post-medieval equivalent of candy. They did not exist in the ancient Mediterranean. Apparently, the Portuguese found a sweet citrus tree in Goa or elsewhere and started breeding it for sweeter and sweeter fruits, like a modern confectionery company. Even the apples we see in the stores are to be regarded with some suspicion. Original apples were devoid of sweet taste, and fruit corporations bred them for maximal sweetness. The mountain apples of my childhood were acid, bitter, crunchy, and much smaller than the shiny variety in U.S. stores, said to keep the doctor away. As to liquid, my rule is drink no liquid that is not at least 1,000 years old, so its fitness has been tested. I drink just wine, water, and coffee. No soft drinks. Perhaps the most possibly deceitfully noxious drink is the orange juice we make poor innocent people imbibe at the breakfast table while, thanks to marketing, we convince them it is healthy. Aside from the point that the citrus our ancestors ingested was not sweet, they never ingested carbohydrates without large, very large quantities of fiber. Eating an orange or an apple is not biologically equivalent to drinking orange or apple juice. From such examples, I derived the rule that what is called healthy is generally unhealthy, just as social networks are antisocial, and the knowledge-based economy is typically ignorant. I would add that, in my own experience, a considerable jump in my personal health has been achieved by removing offensive irritants. Copy the morning newspapers. The mere mention of the names of the fragilista journalists Thomas Friedman or Paul Krugman can lead to explosive bouts of unrequited anger on my part. The boss, the daily commute, air conditioning, though not heating, television, emails from documentary filmmakers, economic forecasts, news about the stock market, gym strength training machines, and many more. One example of lack of empirical wisdom in the use of evidence. In a New York Times Magazine article, a doctor who claimed that he stopped eating sugar because of its potential harm was apologetic for doing so without full evidence. The best test of empirical wisdom in someone is in where he puts the burden of evidence. The Iatrogenics of Money. To understand the outright denial of anti-fragility in the way we seek wealth, consider that construction laborers seem happier with a ham and cheese baguette than businessmen with a Michelin 3-star meal. Food tastes so much better after exertion. The Romans had a strange relation to wealth. Anything that softens or mollifies was seen negatively. Their reputation for decadence is a bit overdone. History likes the lurid. They disliked comfort and understood its side effects. The same with the Semites, split between desert tribes and city dwellers, with city dwellers harboring a certain cross-generational nostalgia for their roots and their original culture. So there is the culture of the desert, full of poetry, chivalry, contemplation, rough episodes, and frugality, plotted against the city's comfort, which is associated with physical and moral decay, gossip, and decadence. The city dweller repairs to the desert for purification, as Christ did for 40 days in the Judean desert, or St. Mark in the Egyptian desert, starting a tradition of such asceticism. There was at some point an epidemic of monasticism in the Levant, perhaps the most impressive being St. Simeon, who spent 40 years on top of a column in northern Syria. The Arabs kept the tradition, shedding possessions to go to silent, barren, empty places, and of course with mandatory fasting, on which a bit later. Note that medical iatrogenics is the result of wealth and sophistication rather than poverty and artlessness, and of course the product of partial knowledge rather than ignorance. So this idea of shedding possessions to go to the desert can be quite potent as a via negativa-style subtractive strategy. Few have considered that money has its own iatrogenics, and that separating some people from their fortune would simplify their lives and bring great benefits in the form of healthy stressors. So being poorer might not be completely devoid of benefits, if one does it right. We need modern civilization for many things, such as the legal system and emergency room surgery. But just imagine how, by the subtractive perspective, via negativa, we can be better off by getting tougher. No sunscreen, no sunglasses if you have brown eyes, no air conditioning, no orange juice, just water. No smooth surfaces, no soft drinks, no complicated pills, no loud music, no elevator, no juicer, no I stop. When I see pictures of my friend the godfather of the paleo-ancestral lifestyle, Art Devaney, who is extremely fit in his 70s, much more than most people 30 years younger than him, and those of the pear-shaped billionaires Rupert Murdoch or Warren Buffett or others in the same age group, I am invariably hit with the following idea. If true wealth consists in worryless sleeping, clear conscience, reciprocal gratitude, absence of envy, good appetite, muscle strength, physical energy, frequent laughs, no meals alone, no gym class, some physical labor or hobby, good bowel movements, no meeting rooms, and periodic surprises, then it is largely subtractive, elimination of iatrogenics. Religion and naive interventionism. Religion has invisible purposes beyond what the literal-minded scientistic scientifiers identify, one of which is to protect us from scientism, that is, them. We can see in the corpus of inscriptions on graves accounts of people erecting fountains or even temples to their favorite gods after these succeeded where doctors failed. Indeed, we rarely look at religion's benefits in limiting the intervention bias and its iatrogenics. In a large set of circumstances, marginal disease, anything that takes you away from the doctor and allows you to do nothing, hence gives nature a chance to do its work, will be beneficial. So going to church, or the Temple of Apollo, for mild cases, say those devoid of trauma, like a mild discomfort, not injuries from a car accident, those situations in which the risk of iatrogenics exceeds the benefit of cure, to repeat it again, the cases with negative convexity, will certainly help. We have so many inscriptions on temples of the type, Apollo saved me, my doctors tried to kill me. Typically the patient has bequeathed his fortune to the temple. And it seems to me that human nature does, deep down, know when to resort to the solace of religion, and when to switch to science. If it's Wednesday, I must be vegan. Sometimes, for a conference dinner, the organizers send me a form asking me if I have dietary requirements. Some do so close to 6 months in advance. In the past, my usual answer had been that I avoid eating cats, dogs, rats, and humans, especially economists. Today, after my personal evolution, I truly need to figure out the day of the week to know if I will be vegan then or capable of eating those thick, monstrous steaks. How? Just by looking at the Greek Orthodox calendar and its required fasts. This confuses the usual categorizing business reader TED conference modern version of the naive fellow, who cannot place me in the paleo camp or the vegan camp. The paleo people are carnivores who try to replicate the supposed ancestral high-meat, high-animal-fat diet of hunter-gatherers. Vegans are people who eat no animal product, not even butter. We will see further down why it is a naive, rationalistic mistake to be in either category, except for religious or spiritual reasons, except episodically. I believe in the heuristics of religion and blindly accommodate its rules. As an Orthodox Christian, I can cheat once in a while, as it is part of the game. Among other things, the role of religion is to tame the iatrogenics of abundance. Fasting makes you lose your sense of entitlement. But there are more subtle aspects. Convexity effects and random nutrition. Recall from the lung ventilator discussion this practical consequence of Jensen's inequality. Irregularity has its benefits in some areas. Regularity has its detriments. Where Jensen's inequality applies, irregularity might be medicine. Perhaps what we mostly need to remove is a few meals at random, or at least avoid steadiness in food consumption. The error of missing non-linearities is found in two places, in the mixture and in the frequency of food intake. The problem with the mixture is as follows. We humans are said to be omnivorous, compared to more specialized mammals, such as cows and elephants, who eat salads, and lions, who eat prey, generally salad-eating prey. But such ability to be omnivorous had to come in response to more variegated environments with unplanned, haphazard, and, what is key, serial availability of sources. Specialization is the response to a very stable habitat free of abrupt changes, redundancy of pathways the response to a more variegated one. diversification of function had to come in response to variety, and a variety of a certain structure. Notice subtlety in the way we are built. The cow and other herbivores are subjected to much less randomness than the lion in their food intake. They eat steadily, but need to work extremely hard in order to metabolize all these nutrients, spending several hours a day just eating. Not to count the boredom of standing there eating salads. The lion, on the other hand, needs to rely on more luck. It succeeds in a small percentage of the kills, less than 20%, but when it eats, it gets in a quick and easy way all these nutrients produced thanks to very hard and boring work by the prey. So take the following principles derived from the random structure of the environment. When we are herbivores, we eat steadily, but when we are predators, we eat more randomly. Hence, our proteins need to be consumed randomly for statistical reasons. So if you agree that we need balanced nutrition of a certain combination, it is wrong to immediately assume that we need such balance at every meal, rather than serially so. Assuming that we need, on average, certain quantities of the various nutrients that have been identified, say, a certain quantity of carbohydrates, proteins, and fats. Some people claim that we need more fat than carbohydrates. Others offer the opposite. They all tend to agree on protein, though few realize we need to randomize protein intake. Both sides still advocate non-randomness in the mixing and ignore the non-linearities from sequence and composition. There is a big difference between getting them together at every meal with the classical steak, salad, followed by fresh fruits, or having them separately, serially. Why? Because deprivation is a stressor, and we know what stressors do when allowed adequate recovery. Convexity effects at work here again. Getting 3 times the daily dose of protein in 1 day and nothing the next 2 is certainly not biologically equivalent to steady, moderate consumption if our metabolic reactions are nonlinear. It should have some benefits. At least this is how we are designed to be. I speculate. In fact, I more than speculate. I am convinced, an inevitable result of nonlinearity, that we are anti-fragile to randomness in food delivery and composition, at least over a certain range or number of days. And one blatant denial of convexity bias is the theory about the benefits of the so-called Cretan or Mediterranean diet that triggered a change in the eating habits of the U.S. enlightened class, away from steak and potatoes in favor of grilled fish with salad and feta cheese. It happened as follows. Someone looked at the longevity of Cretans, cataloged what they ate, then inferred, naively, that they lived longer because of the types of food they consumed. It could be true, but the second-order effect, the variations in intake, could be dominant, something that went unnoticed by mechanistic researchers. Indeed, it took a while to notice the following. The Greek Orthodox Church has, depending on the severity of the local culture, almost 200 days of fasting per year, and these are harrowing fasts. Yes, harrowing fasts, as I am feeling it right now. For I am writing these lines during Orthodox Lent, a 40-day period in which almost no animal product can be consumed, no sweets, and for some sticklers, no olive oil. As there are several gradations, I try to stick to a semi-strict level, and life is not very easy, as is meant to be. I just spent a long weekend in Amyoun, my ancestral village in northern Lebanon, in the Greek Orthodox area called the Kura Valley. There, traditional ruse foods are perfected, with great imagination. Levantine kibbeh made with herbs and beans in place of meat, meatballs made of matzo-style small brown balls in a lentil soup. Remarkably, while fish is banned, most days shellfish is allowed, probably as it was not considered a luxury item. The compensation for the absence of some nutrients from my daily diet will take place in lumps. I will make up my deprivation of what researchers for now call protein with fish on days when it is allowed. And of course I will ravenously eat lamb on Easter Day, then consume disproportionately high quantities of fatty red meat for a while thereafter. I dream of the red steak served in Fat Tony patronized restaurants in unapologetically monstrous portions. And there is this anti-fragility to the stressor of the fast, as it makes the wanted food taste better and can produce euphoria in one's system. Breaking a fast feels like the exact opposite of a hangover. The principal disease of abundance can be seen in habituation and jadedness, what biologists currently call dulling of receptors. Seneca. To a sick person, honey tastes better. How to eat yourself. I wonder how people can accept that the stressors of exercise are good for you, but do not transfer to the point that food deprivation can have the same effect. But scientists are in the process of discovering the effects of episodic deprivation of some or all foods. Somehow, evidence shows, we get sharper and fitter in response to the stress of the constraint. We can look at biological studies, not to generalize or use in the rationalistic sense, but to verify the existence of a human response to hunger, that biological mechanisms are activated by food deprivation. And we have experiments on cohorts showing the positive effect of hunger or deprivation of a food group on the human body. Researchers rationalize now with the mechanism of autophagy, eating oneself. When deprived of external sources, the theories are that your cells start eating themselves, or breaking down proteins and recombining amino acids to provide material for building other cells. It is assumed by some researchers, for now, that the vacuum cleaner effect of autophagy is the key to longevity, though my ideas of the natural are impervious to their theories. As I will show further down, occasional starvation produces some health benefits, and that's that. The response to hunger, our anti-fragility, has been underestimated. We've been telling people to eat a good meal for breakfast so they can face the travails of the day. And it is not a new theory by empirically blind modern-day nutritionists. For instance, I was struck by a dialogue in Stendhal's monumental novel Le Rouge et Le Noir, in which the protagonist, Julien Sorel, is told the work for the day will be long and rough, so let us fortify ourselves with a breakfast, which in the French of the period was called the first lunch. Indeed, the idea of breakfast as a main meal with cereals and other such materials has been progressively shown to be harming humans. I wonder why it took so long before anyone realized that such an unnatural idea needs to be tested. Further, the tests show that harm, or at least no benefits, are derived from breakfast unless one has worked for it beforehand. Let us remember that we are not designed to be receiving foods from the delivery person. In nature, we had to expend some energy to eat. Lions hunt to eat. They don't eat their meal, then hunt for pleasure. Giving people food before they expend energy would certainly confuse their signaling process. And we have ample evidence that intermittently, and only intermittently, depriving organisms of food has been shown to engender beneficial effects on many functions. Walter Longo, for instance, noted that prisoners in concentration camps got less sick in the first phase of food restriction, then broke down later. He tried the result experimentally and found out that mice, in the initial phases of starvation, can withstand high doses of chemotherapy without visible side effects. Scientists use the narrative that starvation causes the expression of a gene coding a protein called SIRT, SIRT1, or sirtuin, which brings longevity and other effects. The anti-fragility of humans manifests itself in the response with upregulation of some genes in response to hunger. So once again, religions with ritual fasts have more answers than assumed by those who look at them too literally. In fact, what these ritual fasts do is try to bring non-linearities in consumption to match biological properties. Walk deprived. Another source of harm from naive rationalism. Just as for a long time people tried to shorten their sleep, as it seemed useless to our earthling logic, many people think that walking is useless, so they use mechanical transportation, car, bicycle, etc., and get their exercise working out at the gym. And when they walk, they do this ignominious power walk, sometimes with weights on their arms. They do not realize that for reasons still opaque to them, walking effortlessly, at a pace below the stress level, can have some benefits, or, as I speculate, is necessary for humans, perhaps as necessary as sleep, which at some point modernity could not rationalize and tried to reduce. Now, it may or may not be true that walking effortlessly is as necessary as sleep, but since all my ancestors until the advent of the automobile spent much of their time walking around and sleeping, I try to just follow the logic, even before some medical journal catches up to the idea and produces what referees of medical journals call evidence. I want to live forever. All I hear is how to live longer, richer, and of course more laden with electronic gadgets. We are not the first generation to believe that the worst possible thing to befall us is death. But for the ancients, the worst possible outcome was not death, but a dishonorable death, or even just a regular one. For a classical hero, dying in a retirement home with a rude nurse and a network of tubes coming into and out of your nose would not be the attractive telos for a life. And, of course, we have this modern illusion that we should live as long as we can, as if we were each the end product. This idea of the me as a unit can be traced to the Enlightenment, and with it, fragility. Before that, we were part of the present collective and future progeny. Both present and future tribes exploited the fragility of individuals to strengthen themselves. People engaged in sacrifices, sought martyrdom, died for the group, and derived pride from doing so. They worked hard for future generations. Sadly, as I am writing these lines, the economic system is loading future generations with public governmental debt, causing depletion of resources and environmental blight to satisfy the requirements of the security analysts and the banking establishment. Once again, we cannot separate fragility from ethics. As I wrote in Chapter 4, while the gene is anti-fragile, since it is information, the carrier of the gene is fragile and needs to be so for the gene to get stronger. We live to produce information or improve on it. Nietzsche had the Latin pun aut liberi, aut libri, either children or books, both information that carries through the centuries. I was just reading in John Gray's wonderful The Immortalization Commission about attempts to use science in a post-religious world to achieve immortality. I felt some deep disgust, as would any ancient, at the efforts of the singularity thinkers, such as Ray Kurzweil, who believe in humans' potential to live forever. Note that if I had defined the anti-me, the person with diametrically opposite ideas and lifestyle on the planet, it would be that Ray Kurzweil fellow. It is not just neomania. While I propose removing offensive elements from people's diets and lives, he works by adding, popping close to 200 pills daily. Beyond that, these attempts at immortality leave me with a deep moral revulsion. It is the same kind of deep internal disgust that takes hold of me when I see a rich 82-year-old man surrounded with babes, 20-something mistresses, often Russian or Ukrainian. I am not here to live forever as a sick animal. Recall that the anti-fragility of a system comes from the mortality of its components, and I am part of that larger population called humans. I am here to die a heroic death for the sake of the collective, to produce offspring, and prepare them for life and provide for them, or eventually, books. My information, that is, my genes, the anti-fragile in me, should be the one seeking immortality, not me. Then say goodbye. Have a nice funeral in St. Sergius, Mar Sarkis, in Amiens, and, as the French say, place à autre. Make room for others. Book 7. The Ethics of Fragility and Anti-Fragility. Now, ethics. Under opacity and in the newfound complexity of the world, people can hide risks and hurt others, with the law incapable of catching them. Iatrogenics has both delayed and invisible consequences. It is hard to see causal links to fully understand what's going on. Under such epistemic limitations, skin in the game is the only true mitigator of fragility. Hammurabi's code provided a simple solution, close to 3,700 years ago. This solution has been increasingly abandoned in modern times, as we have developed a fondness for neomanic complication over archaic simplicity. We need to understand the everlasting solidity of such a solution. Chapter 23. The Agency Problem as Transfer of Fragility. Skin in the Game. Doxastic Commitment or Soul in the Game. The Robert Rubin Problem. The Joseph Stiglitz Problem. And the Alan Blinder Problem. All three about agency, and one about cherry-picking. Skin in the Game. Anti-fragility and optionality at the expense of others. Making talk less cheap. Looking at the spoils. Corporations with random acts of pity. Predict and inverse predict. This chapter will look at what we are getting ourselves into when someone gets the upside and a different person gets the downside. The worst problem of modernity lies in the malignant transfer of fragility and anti-fragility from one party to the other, with one getting the benefits, the other one unwittingly getting the harm, with such transfer facilitated by the growing wedge between the ethical and the legal. This state of affairs has existed before, but is acute today. Modernity hides it especially well. It is, of course, an agency problem. And the agency problem is, of course, an asymmetry. We are witnessing a fundamental change. Consider older societies, those societies that have survived. The main difference between us and them is the disappearance of a sense of heroism, a shift away from a certain respect and power to those who take downside risks for others. For heroism is the exact inverse of the agency problem. Someone elects to bear the disadvantage, risks his own life or harm to himself, or, in milder forms, accepts to deprive himself of some benefits, for the sake of others. What we have currently is the opposite. Power seems to go to those like bankers, corporate executives, non-entrepreneurs, and politicians who steal a free option from society. And heroism is not just about riots and wars. An example of the inverse agency problem. As a child, I was most impressed with the story of a nanny who died in order to save a child from being hit by a car. I find nothing more honorable than accepting death in someone else's place. In other words, what is called sacrifice. And the word sacrifice is related to sacred, the domain of the holy that is separate from that of the profane. In traditional societies, a person is only as respectable and as worthy as the downside he, or more, a lot more than expected, she, is willing to face for the sake of others. The most courageous or valorous occupy the highest rank in their society, knights, generals, commanders. Even mafia dons accept that such rank in the hierarchy makes them the most exposed to be whacked by competitors and the most penalized by the authorities. The same applies to saints, those who abdicate, devote their lives to serve others, to help the weak, the deprived, and the dispossessed. So graphic 7 in your PDF presents another triad. There are those with no skin in the game but who benefit from others, those who neither benefit from nor harm others, and finally, the grand category of those sacrificial ones who take the harm for the sake of others. Let me follow my emotions and start with a third column, on the far right, the one about heroes and people of courage. The robustness, even anti-fragility, of society depends on them. If we are here today, it is because someone at some stage took some risks for us. But courage and heroism do not mean blind risk-taking. It is not necessarily recklessness. There is a pseudo-courage that comes from risk-blindness in which people underestimate the odds of failure. We have ample evidence that the very same people become chicken and overreact in the face of real risks, the exact opposite. For the Stoics, prudence is connatural to courage, the courage to fight your own impulses, in an aphorism by who else, Publius Cyrus. Prudence was deemed the courage of the general. Heroism has evolved through civilization from the martial arena to that of ideas. Initially, in pre-classical times, the Homeric hero was someone principally endowed with physical courage, since everything was physical. In later classical times, for such people as the great Lacedaemonian king Agesilaus, a truly happy life was one crowned by the privilege of death in battle, little else, perhaps even nothing else, But for Agesilaus, courage had already evolved from purely martial prowess into something greater. Courage was often seen in acts of renunciation, as when one is ready to sacrifice himself for the benefit of others, of the collective, something altruistic. Finally, a new form of courage was born, that of the Socratic Plato, which is the very definition of the modern man, the courage to stand up for an idea and enjoy death in a state of thrill, simply because the privilege of dying for truth or standing up for one's values had become the highest form of honor. And no one has had more prestige in history than two thinkers who overtly and defiantly sacrificed their lives for their ideas, two Eastern Mediterraneans, one Greek and one Semite. We should pause a little when we hear happiness defined as an economic or otherwise puny materialistic condition. You can imagine how distraught I feel when I hear about the glorified, heroism-free, middle-class values which, thanks to globalization and the Internet, have spread to any place easily reached by British air, enshrining the usual opiates of the deified classes: hard work for a bank or a tobacco company, diligent newspaper reading, obedience to most but not all traffic laws, captivity in some corporate structure, dependence on the opinion of a boss, with one's job records filed in the personnel department, good legal compliance, reliance on stock market investments, tropical vacations, and a suburban life under some mortgage with a nice-looking dog and Saturday night wine tasting. Those who meet with some success enter the gallery of the annual billionaire list, where they will hope to spend some time before their fertilizer sales are challenged by competitors from China. They will be called heroes rather than lucky. Further, if success is random, a conscious act of heroism is non-random, and the ethical middle class may work for a tobacco company, and thanks to casuistry, call themselves ethical. I am even more distraught for the future of the human race when I see a nerd behind a computer in a D.C. suburb, walking distance from a Starbucks coffee house or a shopping mall, capable of blowing up an entire battalion in a remote place, say Pakistan, and afterward going to the gym for a workout. Compare his culture to that of knights or samurai. Cowardice enhanced by technology is all connected. Society is fragilized by spineless politicians, draft dodgers afraid of polls, and journalists building narratives who create explosive deficits and compound agency problems because they want to look good in the short term. A disclaimer. Graphic 7 does not imply that those with soul in the game are necessarily right, or that dying for one's ideas makes one necessarily good for the rest of us. Many messianic utopians have caused quite a bit of harm. Nor is a grandiose death a necessity. Many people fight evil in the patient grind of their daily lives without looking like heroes. They suffer society's ingratitude even more, while media-friendly pseudo-heroes rise in status. These people will not get a statue from future generations. A half-man, or rather half-person, is not someone who does not have an opinion, just someone who does not take risks for it. The great historian Paul Venn has recently shown that it is a big myth that gladiators were forced labor. Most were volunteers who wanted the chance to become heroes by risking their lives in winning, or, when failing, to show in front of the largest crowd in the world how they were able to die honorably, without cowering. When a gladiator loses the fight, the crowd decides whether he should be spared or put to death by the opponent. And spectators did not care for non-volunteers, as these did not have their soul in the fight. My greatest lesson in courage came from my father. As a child, I had admired him before for his erudition, but was not overly fazed, since erudition on its own does not make a man. He had a large ego and immense dignity, and he demanded respect. He was once insulted by a militiaman at a road check during the Lebanese War. He refused to comply and got angry at the militiaman for being disrespectful. As he drove away, the gunman shot him in the back. The bullet stayed in his chest for the rest of his life, so he had to carry an X-ray image through airport terminals. This set the bar very high for me. Dignity is worth nothing unless you earn it, unless you are willing to pay a price for it. A lesson I learned from this ancient culture is the notion of megalopsychon, a term expressed in Aristotle's Ethics, a sense of grandeur that was superseded by the Christian value of humility. There is no word for it in Romance languages. In Arabic, it is called shahm, best translated as non-small. If you take risks and face your fate with dignity, there is nothing you can do that makes you small. If you don't take risks, there is nothing you can do that makes you grand. Nothing. And when you take risks, insults by half men, small men, those who don't risk anything, are similar to barks by non-human animals. You can't feel insulted by a dog. Hammurabi. Let us now work with the elements of Graphic 7 in your PDF and bring the unifying foundational asymmetry between upside and downside into our central theme, ethics. Just as only business school professors and similar fragilistas separate robustness and growth, we cannot separate fragility and ethics. Some people have options or have optionality at the expense of others, and the others don't know it. The effects of transfers of fragility are becoming more acute as modernity is building up more and more people on the left column, inverse heroes, so to say. So many professions, most arising from modernity, are affected, becoming more anti-fragile at the expense of our fragility. Tenured government employees, academic researchers, journalists of the non-myth-busting variety, the medical establishment, big pharma, and many more. Now, how do we solve the problem? As usual, with some great help from the ancients. Hammurabi's code, now about 3,800 years old, identifies the need to reestablish a symmetry of fragility, spelled out as follows. If a builder builds a house and the house collapses and causes the death of the owner of the house, the builder shall be put to death. If it causes the death of the son of the owner of the house, a son of that builder shall be put to death. If it causes the death of a slave of the owner of the house, he shall give to the owner of the house a slave of equal value. It looks like they were much more advanced 3,800 years ago than we are today. The entire idea is that the builder knows more, a lot more, than any safety inspector, particularly about what lies hidden in the foundations, making it the best risk management rule ever, as the foundation, with delayed collapse, is the best place to hide risk. Hammurabi and his advisors understood small probabilities. Now, clearly the object here is not to punish retrospectively, but to save lives by providing upfront disincentive in case of harm to others during the fulfillment of one's profession. These asymmetries are particularly severe when it comes to small probability extreme events, that is, black swans, as these are the most misunderstood, and their exposure is easiest to hide. Fat Tony has two heuristics. First, never get on a plane if the pilot is not on board. Second, make sure there is also a co-pilot. The first heuristic addresses the asymmetry in rewards and punishment, or transfer of fragility between individuals. Ralph Nader has a simple rule. People voting for war need to have at least one descendant, child or grandchild, exposed to combat. For the Romans, engineers needed to spend some time under the bridge they built, something that should be required of financial engineers today. The English went further and had the families of the engineers spend time with them under the bridge after it was built. To me, every opinion maker needs to have skin in the game in the event of harm caused by reliance on his information or opinion. Not having such persons as, say, the people who helped cause the criminal Iraq invasion come out of it completely unscathed. Further, anyone producing a forecast or making an economic analysis needs to have something to lose from it, given that others rely on those forecasts. To repeat, forecasts induce risk-taking. They are more toxic to us than any other form of human pollution. We can derive plenty of sub-heuristics from Fat Tony's rules, particularly to mitigate the weaknesses of predictive systems. Predicting, any prediction, without skin in the game, can be as dangerous for others as unmanned nuclear plants without the engineer sleeping on the premises. Pilots should be on the plane. The second heuristic is that we need to build redundancy, a margin of safety, avoiding optimization, mitigating, even removing, asymmetries in our sensitivity to risk. The rest of this chapter will present a few syndromes with, of course, some ancient remedies. The Talker's Free Option. We closed Book 1 by arguing that we need to put entrepreneurs and risk-takers, failed or not, on top of the pyramid, and, unless they take personal risks when they expose others, academizing academics, talkers, and political politicians at the bottom. The problem is that society is currently doing the exact opposite, granting mere talkers a free option. The idea that Fat Tony milked suckers when they ran to the exit door seemed at first quite inelegant to Nero. Benefiting from the misfortune of others, no matter how hideous these are and can be, is not the most graceful approach to life. But Tony had something at risk, and would have been personally harmed by an adverse outcome. Fat Tony had no agency problem. This makes it permissible. For there is an even worse problem associated with the opposite situation, people who just talk, prognosticate, theorize. In fact, speculative risk-taking is not just permissible, it is mandatory. No opinion without risk, and of course, no risk without hope for return. If Fat Tony had an opinion, he felt he needed, for ethical reasons, to have a corresponding exposure. As they say in Bensonhurst, you gotta do so if you have an opinion. Otherwise, you do not really have an opinion at all. You need to be earmarked as someone who has no downside for his opinion, with a special status in society, perhaps something below that of ordinary citizen. Commentators need to have a status below ordinary citizen. Regular citizens, at least, face the downside of their statements. So counter to the entire idea of the intellectual and commentator as a detached and protected member of society, I am stating here that I find it profoundly unethical to talk without doing, without exposure to harm, without having one's skin in the game, without having something at risk. You express your opinion. It can hurt others who rely on it. Yet you incur no liability. Is this fair? But this is the information age. The effect of transferring fragility might have been present throughout history, but it is much more acute now, under modernity's connectivity, and the newfound invisibility of causal chains. The intellectual today is vastly more powerful and dangerous than before. The knowledge world causes separation of knowing and doing within the same person, and leads to the fragility of society. How? In the old days, privilege came with obligations, except for the small class of intellectuals who served a patron, or in some cases, the state. You want to be a feudal lord? You will be first to die. You want war? First in battle. Let us not forget something embedded in the U.S. Constitution. The president is commander-in-chief. Caesar, Alexander, and Hannibal were on the battlefield. The last, according to Livy, was first in, last out of combat zones. George Washington, too, went to battle, unlike Ronald Reagan and George W. Bush, who played video games while threatening the lives of others. Even Napoleon was personally exposed to risks. His showing up during a battle was the equivalent of adding 25,000 troops. Churchill showed an impressive amount of physical courage. They were in it. They believed in it. Status implied you took physical risks. Note that in traditional societies, even those who fail, but have taken risks, have a higher status than those who are not exposed. Now, again, the idiocy of predictive systems making me emotional. We may have more social justice today than before the Enlightenment, but we also have more, a lot more, transfers of optionality, more than ever. A patent setback. Let me explain. This knowledge-schnowledge business necessarily means shifting to talk. Talk by academics, consultants, and journalists, when it comes to predictions, can be just talk, devoid of embodiment and stripped of true evidence. As in anything with words, it is not the victory of the most correct, but that of the most charming, or the one who can produce the most academic-sounding material. We mentioned earlier how the political philosopher Raymond Aron sounded uninteresting in spite of his predictive abilities, while those who were wrong about Stalinism survived beautifully. Aron was about as colorless as they come. In spite of his prophetic insights, he looked, wrote, and lived like a tax accountant, while his enemy, say, Jean-Paul Sartre, who led a flamboyant lifestyle, got just about everything wrong and even put up with the occupying Germans in an extremely cowardly manner. Sartre the coward looked radiant, impressive, and alas, his books survived. Please stop calling him a Voltaire. He was no Voltaire. I got nauseous in Davos, making eye contact with the fragilista journalist Thomas Friedman, who, thanks to his influential newspaper op-eds, helped cause the Iraq War. He paid no price for the mistake. The real reason for my malaise was perhaps not just that I saw someone I consider vile and harmful. I just get disturbed when I see wrong and do nothing about it. It is biological. It is guilt for Baal's sake, and guilt is what I do not have to put up with. There is another central element of ancient Mediterranean ethics, factum tecendo, crimen facius acrius. For Publilius Syrus, he who does not stop a crime is an accomplice. I've stated my own version of this in the prologue, which needs to be reiterated. If you see fraud and don't say fraud, you are a fraud. Thomas Friedman was a bit responsible for the Iraq invasion of 2003, and not only paid no penalty for it, but continues to write for the op-ed page of the New York Times, confusing innocent people. He got and kept the upside. Others get the downside. A writer with arguments can harm more people than any serial criminal. I am singling him out here because, at the core, the problem is his promotion of the misunderstanding of iatrogenics in complex systems. He promoted the Earth is flat idea of globalization without realizing that globalization brings fragilities, causes more extreme events as a side effect, and requires a great deal of redundancies to operate properly. And the very same error holds with the Iraq invasion. In such a complex system, the predictability of the consequences is very low, so invading was epistemologically irresponsible. Natural and ancestral systems work by penalties. No perpetual free option given to anyone. So does society in many things, with visible effects. If someone drives a school bus blindfolded and has an accident, he either exits the gene pool the old-fashioned way, or, if for some reason he is not harmed by the accident, he will incur enough penalties to be prevented from driving other people ever again. The problem is that the journalist Thomas Friedman is still driving the bus. There is no penalty for opinion makers who harm society, and this is a very bad practice. The Obama administration was, after the crisis of 2008, populated with people who drove the bus blindfolded. The iatrogenists got promoted. Post-dicting. Words are dangerous. Post-dictors who explain things after the fact, because they are in the business of talking, always look smarter than predictors. Because of the retrospective distortion, people who, of course, did not see an event coming will remember some thought to the effect that they did, and will manage to convince themselves that they predicted it, before proceeding to convince others. There will be, after every event, many more post-dictors than true predictors, people who had an idea in the shower without taking it to its logical conclusion, and, given that many people take a lot of showers, say, nearly twice a day, if you include the gym or the episode with the mistress, they will have a large repertoire to draw from. They will not remember the numerous bath-generated ideas they had in the past that were either noise or that contradicted the observed present. But as humans crave self-consistency, they will retain those elements of what they thought in the past that cohere with their perception of the present. So opinion makers who were so proudly and professionally providing idle babble will eventually appear to win an argument, since they are the ones writing, and suckers who got in trouble from reading them will again look to them for future guidance, and will again get in trouble. The past is fluid, marred with selection biases, and constantly revised memories. It is a central property of suckers that they will never know they were the suckers, because that's how our minds work. Even so, one is struck with the following fact. The Fragilista crisis that started in 2007-2008 had many, many fewer near predictors than random. The asymmetry, anti-fragility of post-dictors. Post-dictors can cherry-pick and produce instances in which their opinions played out and discard mispredictions into the bowels of history. It is like a free option to them. We pay for it. Since they have the option, the Fragilistas are personally anti-fragile. Volatility tends to benefit them. the more volatility, the higher the illusion of intelligence. But evidence of whether one has been a sucker or a non-sucker is easy to ferret out by looking at actual records, actions. Actions are symmetric, do not allow cherry-picking, remove the free option. When you look at the actual history of someone's activities, instead of what thoughts he will deliver after the facts, things become crystal clear. The option is gone. Reality removes the uncertainty, the imprecision, the vagueness, the self-serving mental biases that make us appear more intelligent. Mistakes are costly, no longer free, but being right brings actual rewards. Of course, there are other checks one can do to assess the bullshit component of life. Investigate people's decisions as expressed through their own investments. You would discover that many people who claimed to have foreseen the collapse of the financial system had financial companies in their portfolios. Indeed, there was no need to profit from events like Tony and Nero to show non-suckerness. Just avoiding being hurt by them would have been sufficient. I want predictors to have visible scars on their body from prediction errors, not distribute these errors to society. You cannot sit and moan about the world. You need to come out on top. So Tony was right to insist that Nero take a ritual look at the physical embodiment of the spoils, like a bank account statement. As we said, it had nothing to do with financial value, nor purchasing power, just symbolic value. We saw in Chapter 9 how Julius Caesar needed to incur the cost of having Vercingetorix brought to Rome and paraded. An intangible victory has no value. Verba volant. Words fly. Never have people who talk and don't do been more visible and played a larger role than in modern times. This is the product of modernism and division of tasks. Recall that I said that America's strength was risk-taking and harboring risk-takers, the right kind, the Thalesian king of high-failure, long-optionality type. Sorry, but we have been moving away from this model. The Stiglitz Syndrome. There is something more severe than the problem with Thomas Friedman, which can be generalized to represent someone causing action while being completely unaccountable for his words. The phenomenon I will call the Stiglitz Syndrome, after an academic economist of the so-called intelligent variety called Joseph Stiglitz, is as follows. Remember the fragility detection in Chapter 19 and my obsession with Fannie Mae. Luckily, I had some skin in the game for my opinions, be it through exposure to a smear campaign. And in 2008, no surprise, Fannie Mae went bust, I repeat, costing the U.S. taxpayer hundreds of billions and counting. Generally, the financial system, with similar risks, exploded. The entire banking system had similar exposures. But around the same period, Joseph Stiglitz, with two colleagues, the Orzag brothers, Peter and Jonathan, looked at the very same Fannie Mae. They asserted in a report that, on the basis of historical experience, the risk to the government from a potential default on GSE debt is effectively zero. GSE is Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. They both blew up. Supposedly, they ran simulations, but didn't see the obvious. They also said that the probability of a default was found to be so small that it is difficult to detect. It is statements like these, and to me, only statements like these, intellectual hubris and the illusion of understanding of rare events, that caused the buildup of these exposures to rare events in the economy. This is the black swan problem that I was fighting. This is Fukushima. Now, the culmination is that Stiglitz writes in 2010 in his I Told You So book that he claims to have predicted the crisis that started in 2007-2008. Look at this aberrant case of anti-fragility provided to Stiglitz and his colleagues by society. It turns out that Stiglitz was not just a non-predictor, by my standards, but was also part of the problem that caused the events, these accumulations of exposures to small probabilities. But he did not notice it. An academic is not designed to remember his opinions because he doesn't have anything at risk from them. At the core, people are dangerous when they have that strange skill that allows their papers to be published in journals but decreases their understanding of risk. So the very same economist who caused the problem then post-dicted the crisis and then became a theorist on what happened. No wonder we will have larger crises. The central point. Had Stiglitz been a businessman with his own money on the line, he would have blown up, terminated. Or had he been in nature, his genes would have been made extinct, so people with such misunderstanding of probability would eventually disappear from our DNA. What I found nauseating was the government hiring one of his co-authors. I find it truly disgusting that one of the Orzag brothers, Peter, after the crisis, got a job with the Obama administration. Another rehiring of blindfolded bus drivers. Then he became vice chairman of Citibank, which explains why Citibank will blow up again, and we taxpayers will end up subsidizing his high salary. I am reluctantly calling the syndrome by Stiglitz's name because I find him the smartest of economists, one with the most developed intellect for things on paper, except that he has no clue about the fragility of systems. And Stiglitz symbolizes harmful misunderstanding of small probabilities by the economics establishment. It is a severe disease, one that explains why economists will blow us up again. The Stiglitz syndrome corresponds to a form of cherry-picking, the nastiest variety because the perpetrator is not aware of what he is doing. It is a situation in which someone doesn't just fail to detect a hazard, but contributes to its cause while ending up convincing himself, and sometimes others, of the opposite, namely, that he predicted it and warned against it. It corresponds to a combination of remarkable analytical skills, blindness to fragility, selective memory, and absence of skin in the game. Stiglitz syndrome equals fragilista with good intentions plus ex post cherry picking. There are other lessons here related to the absence of penalty. This is an illustration of the academics who write papers and talk syndrome in its greatest severity, unless, as we will see, they have their soul in it. So many academics propose something in one paper, then the opposite in another paper, without penalty to themselves from having been wrong in the first paper, since there is a need only for consistency within a single paper, not across one's career. This would be fine, as someone may evolve and contradict earlier beliefs, but then the earlier result should be withdrawn from circulation and superseded with a new one. With books, the new edition supersedes the preceding one. This absence of penalty makes them anti-fragile at the expense of the society that accepts the rigor of their results. Further, I am not doubting Stiglitz's sincerity, or some weak form of sincerity. I believe he genuinely thinks he predicted the financial crisis. So let me rephrase the problem. The problem with people who do not incur harm is that they can cherry-pick from statements they've made in the past, many of them contradictory, and end up convincing themselves of their intellectual lucidity on the way to the World Economic Forum at Davos. There is the iatrogenics of the medical charlatan and snake oil salesperson causing harm, but he sort of knows it and lies low after he is caught. And there is the far more vicious form of iatrogenics by experts who use their more acceptable status to claim later that they warned of harm. As these did not know they were causing iatrogenics, they cure iatrogenics with iatrogenics. Then things explode. Finally, the cure to many ethical problems maps to the exact cure for the Stiglitz effect, which I state now. Never ask anyone for their opinion, forecast, or recommendation. Just ask them what they have or don't have in their portfolio. We now know that many innocent retirees have been harmed by the incompetence of the rating agencies. It was a bit more than incompetence. Many subprime loans were toxic waste dressed as AAA, meaning near government grade in safety. People were innocently led into putting their savings into them, and further, regulators were forcing portfolio managers to use the assessment of the rating agencies. But rating agencies are protected. They present themselves as press without the noble mission of the press to expose frauds. And they benefit from the protection of free speech, the First Amendment, so ingrained in American habits. My humble proposal? One should say whatever he wants, but one's portfolio needs to line up with it. And, of course, regulators should not be fragilistas by giving their stamp to predictive approaches, hence junk science. The psychologist Gerd Gigerenzer has a simple heuristic. Never ask the doctor what you should do. Ask him what he would do if he were in your place. You would be surprised at the difference. The problem of frequency, or how to lose arguments. Recall that Fat Tony was in favor of just making a buck, as opposed to being proven right. The point has a statistical dimension. Let us return to the distinction between Thalesian and Aristotelian for a minute and look at evolution from the following point of view. The frequency, that is, how often someone is right, is largely irrelevant in the real world. But alas, one needs to be a practitioner, not a talker, to figure it out. On paper, the frequency of being right matters, but only on paper. Typically, fragile payoffs have little, sometimes no, upside, and anti-fragile payoffs have little downside. This means that one makes pennies to lose dollars in the fragile case, makes dollars to lose pennies in the anti-fragile one. So the anti-fragile can lose for a long time with impunity, so long as he happens to be right once. For the fragile, a single loss can be terminal. Accordingly, if you were betting on the downfall of, say, a portfolio of financial institutions because of their fragilities, it would have cost you pennies over the years preceding their eventual demise in 2008, as Nero and Tony did. Note again that taking the other side of fragility makes you anti-fragile. You were wrong for years, right for a moment, losing small, winning big, so vastly more successful than the other way. Actually, the other way would be bust. So you would have made the Thecles like Thales, because betting against the fragile is anti-fragile. But someone who had merely predicted the event with just words would have been called by the journalists wrong for years, wrong most of the time, etc. Should we keep tally of opinion makers right and wrong, the proportion does not matter, as we need to include consequences. And given that this is impossible, we are now in a quandary. Look at it again, the way we looked at entrepreneurs. They are usually wrong and make mistakes, plenty of mistakes. They are convex. So what counts is the payoff from success. Let me rephrase again. Decision-making in the real world, that is, deeds, are Thalesian, while forecasting in words is Aristotelian. As we saw in the discussion in Chapter 12, one side of a decision has larger consequences of the other. We don't have evidence that people are terrorists, but we check them for weapons. We don't believe the water is poisonous, but we avoid drinking it, something that would be absurd for someone narrowly applying Aristotelian logic. To put in Fat Tony terms, suckers try to be right, non-suckers try to make the buck, or suckers try to win arguments, non-suckers try to win. To put it again in other words, it is rather a good thing to lose arguments. The right decision for the wrong reason. More generally, for Mother Nature, opinions and predictions don't count. Surviving is what matters. There is an evolutionary argument here. It appears to be the most underestimated argument in favor of free enterprise and a society driven by individual doers, what Adam Smith called adventurers, not central planners and bureaucratic apparatuses. We saw that bureaucrats, whether in government or large corporations, live in a system of rewards based on narratives, talk, and the opinion of others, with job evaluation and peer reviews. In other words, what we call marketing. Aristotelian, that is. Yet the biological world evolves by survival, not opinions, and I predicted, and I told you so. Evolution dislikes the confirmation fallacy, endemic in society. The economic world should, too, but institutions mess things up, as suckers may get bigger. Institutions block evolution with bailouts and statism. Note that, in the long term, social and economic evolution nastily takes place by surprises, discontinuities, and jumps. My suggestion to deter too big to fail and prevent employers from taking advantage of the public is as follows. A company that is classified as potentially bailable out should it fail should not be able to pay anyone more than a corresponding civil servant. Otherwise, people should be free to pay each other what they want, since it does not affect the taxpayer. Such limitation would force companies to stay small enough that they would not be considered for a bailout in the event of their failure. We mentioned earlier Karl Popper's ideas on evolutionary epistemology. Not being a decision-maker, he was under the illusion that ideas compete with each other, with the least wrong surviving at any point in time. He missed the point that it is not ideas that survive, but people who have the right ones, or societies that have the correct heuristics, or the ones, right or wrong, that lead them to do the good thing. He missed the Thalesian effect, the fact that a wrong idea that is harmless can survive. Those who have wrong heuristics, but with a small harm in the event of error, will survive. Behavior called irrational can be good if it is harmless. Let me give an example of a type of false belief that is helpful for survival. In your opinion, which is more dangerous, to mistake a bear for a stone or mistake a stone for a bear? It is hard for humans to make the first mistake. Our intuitions make us overreact at the smallest probability of harm and fall for a certain class of false patterns. Those who overreact upon seeing what may look like a bear have had a survival advantage. Those who made the opposite mistake left the gene pool. Our mission is to make talk less cheap. The Ancients and the Stiglitz Syndrome. We saw how the ancients understood the Stiglitz Syndrome and associated ones rather well. In fact, they had quite sophisticated mechanisms to counter most aspects of agency problems, whether individual or collective, the circular effect of hiding behind the collective. Earlier, I mentioned the Romans forcing engineers to spend time under the bridge they built. They would have had Stiglitz and Orzog sleep under the bridge of Fannie Mae and exit the gene pool so they wouldn't harm us again. The Romans had even more powerful heuristics for situations few today have thought about, solving potent game-theoretic problems. Roman soldiers were forced to sign a sacramentum, accepting punishment in the event of failure, a kind of pact between the soldier and the army, spelling out commitment for upside and downside. Assume that you and I are facing a small leopard or a wild animal in the jungle. The two of us can possibly overcome it by joining forces, but each one of us is individually weak. Now, if you run away, all you need to be is just faster than me, not faster than the animal. So it would be optimal for the one who can run away the fastest, that is, the most cowardly, to just be a coward and let the other one perish. The Romans removed the soldier's incentive to be a coward and hurt others, thanks to a process called decimation. If a legion loses a battle and there is suspicion of cowardice, 10% of the soldiers and commanders are put to death, usually by random lottery. Decimation, meaning eliminating 1 in 10, has been corrupted by modern language. The magic number is 1 in 10, or something equivalent. Putting more than 10% to death would lead to weakening of the army. Too little, and cowardice would be a dominant strategy. And the mechanism must have worked well as a deterrent against cowardice, since it was not commonly applied. The English applied a version of it. Admiral John Byng was court-martialed and sentenced to death, as he was found guilty of failing to do his utmost to prevent Minorca from falling to the French following the Battle of Minorca in 1757. To burn one's vessels. Playing on one's inner agency problem can go beyond symmetry. Give soldiers no options and see how anti-fragile they can get. On April 29, 711, the armies of the Arab commander Tariq crossed the Strait of Gibraltar from Morocco into Spain with a small army. The name Gibraltar is derived from the Arabic Jabal Tariq, meaning Mount of Tariq. Upon landing, Tariq had his ships put to the fire. He then made a famous speech every schoolchild memorized during my school days that I translate loosely. Behind you is the sea, before you the enemy. You are vastly outnumbered. All you have is sword and courage. And Tariq and his small army took control of Spain. The same heuristic seems to have played out throughout history, from Cortes in Mexico 800 years later, to Agathocles of Syracuse 800 years earlier. Ironically, Agathocles was heading southward in the opposite direction as Tariq, as he was fighting the Carthaginians and landed in Africa. Never put your enemies back to the wall. How poetry can kill you. Ask a polyglot who knows Arabic who he considers the best poet in any language, and odds are that he would answer Al-Mutanabbi, who lived about 1,000 years ago. His poetry in the original has a hypnotic effect on the reader. Listener, rivaled only by the grip of Pushkin on Russian speakers. The problem is that Al-Mutanebbi knew it. His name was literally "He Who Thinks of Himself as a Prophet," on account of his perceived oversized ego. For a taste of his bombast, one of his poems informs us that his poetry is so potent that blind people can read it and deaf people can listen to it. Well, Al-Mutanebbi was that rare case of a poet with skin in the game, dying for his poetry. For in the same egotistical poem, Al-Mutanebbi boasts, in a breathtaking display of linguistic magic, that he walks the walk, in addition to being the most imaginably potent poet, which I insist he was. He knew the horse, the night, the desert, the pen, the book. And thanks to his courage, he got respect from the lion. Well, the poem cost him his life. For Al-Mutanebbi had, characteristically, vilified a desert tribe in one of his poems, and they were out to get him. They reached him as he was traveling. As he was outnumbered, he started to do the rational thing and run away. Nothing shameful, except that one of his companions started reciting "The Horse, the Night" back at him. He turned around and confronted the tribe to his certain death. Thus, Al-Mutanebbi remains, 1,000 years later, the poet who died simply to avoid the dishonor of running away. And when we recite his verses, we know they are genuine. My childhood role model was the French adventurer and writer André Malraux. He imbued his writings with his own risk-taking. Malraux was a school dropout, while extremely well-read, who became an adventurer in Asia in his 20s. He was an active pilot during the Spanish Civil War, and later an active member of the French underground resistance during the Second World War. He turned out to be a bit of a mythomaniac, unnecessarily glorifying his meetings with great men and statesmen. He just could not bear the idea of a writer being an intellectual. But unlike Hemingway, who was mostly into image building, he was the real thing. And he never engaged in small talk. His biographer reports that while other writers were discussing copyrights and royalties, he would steer the conversation to theology. He supposedly said, "The 21st century will be religious or will not be." One of my saddest days was when he died. The problem of insulation. The system does not give researchers the incentive to be a Malraux. The great skeptic Hume was said to leave his skeptical angst in the philosophical cabinet, then go party with his friends in Edinburgh, though his idea of partying was rather too Edinburgh. The philosopher Miles Berniet called this the problem of insulation, particularly with skeptics who are skeptics in one domain but not another. He provides the example of a philosopher who puzzles about the reality of time, but who nonetheless applies for a research grant to work on the philosophical problem of time during next year's sabbatical, without doubting the reality of next year's arrival. For Berniet, the philosopher insulates his ordinary first-order judgments from the effects of his philosophizing. "Sorry, Professor Dr. Berniet, I agree that philosophy is the only field, and its sibling, pure mathematics, that does not need to connect to reality. But then make it a parlor game and give it another name." Likewise, Gerd Gigerenzer reports a more serious violation on the part of Harry Markowitz, who started a method called portfolio selection and received the same iatrogenic Swedish Riksbank prize, called Nobel in economics, for it, like other fragilistas such as Fragilista Merton and Fragilista Stiglitz. I spent part of my adult life calling it charlatanism, as it has no validity outside of academic endorsements and causes blow-ups. Well, Dr. Professor Fragilista Markowitz does not use his method for his own portfolio. He has recourse to more sophisticated and simpler-to-implement cab driver's methodologies, closer to the one Mandelbrot and I have proposed. I believe that forcing researchers to eat their own cooking whenever possible solves a serious problem in science. Take this simple heuristic. Does the scientific researcher whose ideas are applicable to the real world apply his ideas to his daily life? If so, take him seriously. Otherwise, ignore him. If the fellow is doing pure mathematics or theology or teaching poetry, then there is no problem. But if he is doing something applicable, then red flag. This brings us to Triphat-type fakeness compared to Seneca, the talker versus the doer. I applied this method of ignoring what an academic writes and focusing on what he does when I met a researcher on happiness who held that anything one makes beyond $50,000 does not bring any additional happiness. He was then earning more than twice that at a university, so according to his metric, he was safe. The argument seen through his experiments, published in highly cited papers, that is, by other academics, seemed convincing on paper. Although I am not particularly crazy about the notion of happiness or the vulgarity of the modern interpretation of seeking happiness. So, like an idiot, I believed him. But a year or so later, I heard that he was particularly avid for dollars and spent his time on the road speaking for fees. That, to me, was more sufficient evidence than thousands of citations. Champagne socialism. Another blatant case of insulation. Sometimes the divorce between one's talk and one's life can be overtly and convincingly visible. Take people who want others to live a certain way, but don't really like it for themselves. Never listen to a leftist who does not give away his fortune or does not live the exact lifestyle he wants others to follow. What the French call the caviar left, la gauche caviar, or what Anglo-Saxons call champagne socialists, are people who advocate socialism, sometimes even communism, or some political system with sumptuary limitations, while overtly leading a lavish lifestyle, often financed by inheritance, not realizing the contradiction that they want others to avoid just such a lifestyle. It is not too different from the womanizing popes, such as John XII or the Borgias. The contradiction can exceed the ludicrous, as with French President François Mitterrand of France, who, coming in on a socialist platform, emulated the pomp of French monarchs. Even more ironic, his traditional arch-enemy, the conservative General de Gaulle, led a life of old-style austerity and had his wife sew his socks. I have witnessed even worse. A former client of mine, a rich fellow with what appeared to be a social mission, tried to pressure me to write a check to a candidate in an election on a platform of higher taxes. I resisted on ethical grounds, but I thought that the fellow was heroic, for should the candidate win, his own taxes would increase by a considerable amount. A year later, I discovered that the client was being investigated for his involvement in a very large scheme to be shielded from taxes. He wanted to be sure that others paid more taxes. I developed a friendship over the past few years with the activist Ralph Nader and saw contrasting attributes. Aside from an astonishing amount of personal courage and total indifference toward smear campaigns, he exhibits absolutely no divorce between what he preaches and his lifestyle. None. Just like saints who have soul in their game. The man is a secular saint. Soul in the game. There is a class of people who escape bureaucrato-journalistic talk, those who have more than their skin in the game. They have their soul in the game. Consider prophets. Prophecy is a pledge of belief, little else. A prophet is not someone who first had an idea. He is the one to first believe in it and take it to its conclusion. Chapter 20 discussed prophecy, when done right, as subtraction and detection of fragility. But if having skin in the game and accepting downside is what distinguishes the genuine thinker from ex post talk, there is one step beyond needed to reach the rank of prophet. It is a matter of commitment, or what philosophers call doxastic commitment, a type of belief pledge that to Fat Tony and Nero needed to be translated into deeds, the reverse Stiglitz. Doxa in Greek used to mean belief, but distinguished from knowledge, episteme. To see how it involves a commitment of sorts beyond just words, consider that in Church Greek it took the meaning of glorification. Incidentally, this notion applies to all manner of ideas and theories. The main person behind a theory, the person to be called the originator, is someone who believed in it in a doxastic way, with a costly commitment to take it to its natural conclusion, and not necessarily the first person to mention it over dessert wine or in a footnote. Only he who has true beliefs will avoid eventually contradicting himself and falling into the errors of post-dicting. Options, anti-fragility, and social fairness. the stock market, the greatest industrial-sized transfer of anti-fragility in history due to a vicious form of asymmetric skin in the game. I am not talking about investment here, but the current system of packaging investments into shares of public corporations, with managers allowed to game the system, and of course getting more prestige than the real risk-takers, the entrepreneurs. A blatant manifestation of the agency problem is the following. There is a difference between a manager running a company that is not his own and an owner-operated business in which the manager does not need to report numbers to anyone but himself, and for which he has a downside. Corporate managers have incentives without disincentives, something the general public doesn't quite get, as they have the illusion that managers are properly incentivized. Somehow these managers have been given free options by innocent savers and investors. I am concerned here with managers of businesses that are not owner-operated. As I am writing these lines, the United States stock market has cost retirees more than $3 trillion in losses over the past dozen years, compared to leaving money in government money market funds. I am being generous. The difference is even higher. While managers of the companies composing the stock market, thanks to the asymmetry of the stock option, are richer by close to $400 billion. They pulled a Thales on these poor savers. Even more outrageous is the fate of the banking industry. Banks have lost more than they ever made in their history, with their managers being paid billions in compensation. Taxpayers take the downside, bankers get the upside. And the policies aiming at correcting the problem are hurting innocent people, while bankers are sipping the Rosé de Provence brand of summer wine on their yachts in Saint-Tropez. The asymmetry is visibly present. Volatility benefits managers since they only get one side of the payoffs. The main point, alas missed by almost everyone, is that they stand to gain from volatility. The more variations, the more value to this asymmetry. Hence, they are anti-fragile. To see how transfer of anti-fragility works, consider two scenarios in which the market does the same thing on average, but following different paths. Path 1. Market goes up 50%, then goes back down to erase all gains. Path 2. Market does not move at all. Visibly, Path 1, the more volatile, is more profitable to the managers, who can